George Floyd was killed, I think most Black folks weighed, you know, which is the greater of the pandemic.
So if you really are honest about it, to call them essential workers is a lie. It's like calling a prison a correctional institution.
We're teaming up with the rest of the world, and we plan to put our labor where our mouth is.
And to the young people, we need you here today. We need you here tomorrow.
We're finding a way to remain physically distant, but socially connected, and that's worth a smile or two.
From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from the Pacifica Network and radio affiliates. I am your host, Nana Jumpfee. In today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy, we hear from the political prisoner, Black Panther, and journalist, Mumia Abu-Jamal. The international longshore workers' union strike in Oakland, California. Voices of protesters and organizers from the streets of New York. And from New Orleans, activist and infectious disease physician, Dr. Mark Allen Derry. But first, the news.
I'm Eileen Alfandary with KPFA News Headlines. The Georgia NAACP plans to march on the state capitol in the wake of the weekend's fatal Atlanta police shooting of Rashard Brooks. The march was previously planned to demand lawmakers address failures in the criminal justice and electoral systems. Now it has the added focus of the police killing of Brooks, a 27-year-old Black man. The Brooks family attorney said there was no justification for shooting Brooks in the back as he fled with an officer's taser. The Atlanta police chief resigned hours after the shooting. Police announced Sunday one officer had been fired and another placed on administrative duty. Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms spoke Saturday.
I do not believe that this was a justified use of deadly force and have called for the immediate termination of the officer.
The officer was fired. Brooks leaves behind four children. On Friday, he had celebrated the eighth birthday of one of his daughters. Los Angeles County Sheriff Alex Villanueva is scheduled to hold an online town hall to address the death of a Black man found hanging from a tree in the city of Palmdale. Today's meeting will come amid increasing pressure to conduct an independent inquiry into last week's death of Robert Fuller. The coroner's office initially said the 24-year-old appeared to have died by suicide. That prompted an outcry by his family and community members calling for an independent inquiry and autopsy. California deaths from COVID-19 have topped 5,000. According to statistics compiled by the San Francisco Chronicle, 27 people died in the state yesterday from COVID-19, including five in the Bay Area. Last week, nine counties reported a spike in new cases or hospitalizations. Parts of China and India are locking down again after new COVID-19 cases. Beijing reinstated measures to control the spread of the coronavirus amid a growing outbreak. Many of the Beijing new cases have been traced to a wholesale market that supplies much of the capital's meat and vegetables. Beijing closed the market and ordered testing of its workers and a quarantine for anyone who visited it.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
Dr. Malina Abdullah is a mom of three beautiful and brilliant Black children, co-founder and lead organizer of Black Lives Matter Los Angeles, and a professor and former chair of the Pan-African Studies Department at Cal State LA. Greetings, Malina.
Greetings, Sister Nana. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you on this inaugural show. Thank you for agreeing to join us. When the emergency orders first came down from state and local governments in response to COVID-19, many Black organizers were concerned about how we'd be able to physically assemble in protest, especially given the disproportionate death rates for Black folks in most major cities as a result of the pandemic. After the murder of George Floyd, those concerns kind of went out the window. What changed? And is there a way to responsibly consider both pandemics?
We moved a lot of the protests online. We tried to do online organizing. And then something happened when George Floyd was killed. You know, we were very concerned that, you know, the rollback of rights would be a permanent thing and have permanent implications. But when George Floyd was killed, I think most Black folks weighed, you know, which is the greater of the pandemics, right? And we realized that eventually coronavirus is not going to be something that we're talking about. But for the duration of our presence in this country, we've been talking about police violence on Black people. And so for us, for me, as the mom of three kids, you know, of course we don't want to catch COVID-19. Of course, we want to be aware that it's out there and that it's real. However, we can't just let these murders continue to happen. And it actually seemed like there was a ramping up of the murder of Black people at hands of police under the coronavirus pandemic. So we absolutely saw, you know, police use this as a moment to come into Black communities with either even greater force than they had been in the past. So everywhere from Los Angeles to New York, you see police, everybody's seen the video of the young mom and her daughter being snatched off the subway and thrown face down and arrested in front of her young child for not wearing her mask correctly. Right? We know, hopefully people have seen also the videos out of Los Angeles where there were Black people assembled in a park and police came through and, you know, grabbed a man who was just leaving the restroom, arrested, I think it was six people, and charged three of them with nothing more than resisting arrest. And then they said that had nothing to do with the pandemic, but COVID-19 and violations, supposed violations of safer at home orders were the premise by which they even came in the first place. And so we were very concerned about COVID-19, but also saw the way that police were using this as cover to brutalize, surveil, and kill us to an even greater degree. And so when George Floyd is killed, I think that a lot of us had been having concerns already and we're feeling frustrated already. And, you know, you and I are both spiritual people. I think that there was something about Brother George's spirit that shook us out of confinement, that said, you know what, this is the last one. We cannot be at home. It's time to get up. And so we flooded the streets, and initially Black Lives Matter LA, we planned our first planned demonstration. So Brother George was killed on a Monday. We got word of it on Tuesday and then had the protest on Wednesday, and the first protest that we organized. And we had these kind of imaginings that people would come out with their masks and keep 6 feet apart. And that just didn't happen. You know, there were thousands upon thousands of people. They were outraged. We were outraged. And, you know, we tried to keep our masks on, but the social distancing was just something that was not at the top of the priority list. And I think that it's just one where we say, you know, we'll have to risk it. There's some things that are worth the risk, and the lives of our people are worth the risk, the immediate lives of our people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what are we demanding, and what concessions do we expect to see on the near horizon?
We developed a set of 55 demands that we called the Black LA demands. that included both the immediate needs of Black community as well as the long-term needs, right? So this language around underlying conditions had started to emerge, and they were like, oh, Black people are dying because they have diabetes at higher rates, or they have asthma at higher rates, or they have high blood pressure at higher rates. All of these things, though, these ailments come from racism, right? We have diabetes at higher rates because there's food deserts and we don't have access to healthy food or time to exercise, right? What do we do about our houseless folks? So in Los Angeles County, there are at least 60,000 houseless folks living on the streets. Most of them are Black. On Skid Row, the estimates are that the population is 70 to 80% Black, making it the densest Black population in the city. And you see a mayor being forced and a county being forced to grapple with, what about houseless folks in the midst of a pandemic? At the same time as you have this huge houseless community where they're not being provided for at all initially, right? Where we're going, you're saying wash your hands, but houseless folks don't even have access to bathrooms. What are you talking about? You see some work being done, autonomous work being done by Black revolutionary leaders and thinkers like Pete White out of LA Community Action Network, who they go and set up their own hand washing stations because the city and county wouldn't do it, so they make their own. So it kind of shames Garcetti, the mayor of Los Angeles, and the county into doing a little more. And so we're also seeing the crash of the tourism industry. So you got all of these unoccupied hotel rooms, and we're saying put houseless folks in the hotel rooms. There's initially a pushback, but then people go, yeah, it does look ridiculous. And so finally we get some hotel rooms opened. What I want to lift up is they could have done it all along. And I think that's the point of the question, right? That they could have been created housing for houseless folks. They could have been made sure that people had access to healthy foods. They could have been doing all of these things, but they had made different political choices. And the only reason that we're being able to usher some of these things through now, and only to a degree, because there was just a protest yesterday at Echo Park Lake where there's hundreds of houseless folks, but also houseless folks who are being criminalized for being houseless, right? So we're ushering these things through. What we need to do is figure out how to expand them and make sure that these wins are permanent.
Thank you so very much, Sister Melina. It's always great to have conversations with you. It's great to be working with you. I'm on these front lines. Really appreciate you. May the ancestors continue to guide and protect you.
Thank you so much, Sister Nana. I appreciate you too.
Next on COVID, Race, and Democracy, a message from Black Panther, world-acclaimed journalist, and political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal with Prison Radio on how COVID-19 is impacting people who are incarcerated.
Well, we don't see much because we're locked up 23 hours and 15 minutes every day. That is to say, everybody in prison all across the state of Pennsylvania are under this emergency decree of, it was March 13th or 15th. Ever since then, we've been locked down 23 hours and 15 minutes. So you're out of the cell 45 minutes a day. It can be morning, afternoon, or night. But in that 45 minutes, you gotta bathe, you can call a friend or family, you can get on the kiosk, you can clean your cell. Other than that, you're locked in your cell. It's like the whole state is a hole. H-O-L-E now. And that's how it was on death row. That's how it was in the hole. Well, it's like that all around now. And the name of health. We've heard that people have been sick, mostly in Phoenix, which is near Philadelphia, but there have been other outbreaks, but there isn't a lot of coverage of that. The counties seem to have been getting it the worst. Of course, they're closest to the community. You know, people are coming in and going out. And I'm speaking of staff members, volunteers, visitors, you name it. But what happens in the counties makes its way to the state. It's just a matter of time. I think mass incarceration has become, I hate to say it, but I believe it, normalized. That is to say, for all intents and purposes, who gives a damn? And, you know, while your family or your loved ones might care, the so-called average American, even the average American who is himself locked down in his home or her home, they find this intolerable. They find it outrageous. They're going nuts. But, you know, Pennsylvania, New York, under the crazy Rockefeller drug laws, all across the country, you've got millions of people who are locked down, you know, for years. In Pennsylvania, for decades. Like Maroon Schultz and other people who've been locked down for decades in solitary confinement. And so, you know, people are getting a taste of this, even though it's a relaxed, distant taste. It's a taste. Because you can't go out when you want to go out. You can't leave. You're locked in. And it's safer, to be frank. And, you know, what we've seen is people kind of burst loose. And I hope I missed my guess. I hope I'm wrong. But I have a sneaking suspicion that we're going to see a second wave in this country. And the fact that it's already the country with the highest number of COVID-19 related deaths tells me we're going to see some really great days and some really high numbers. The numbers are jumping. It must be 2,000 a day, 1,300 to 2,500 a day. And those numbers are rising. In the last few weeks, they've gone from hundreds to tens of thousands.
You know, how does it feel to you about the fact that even though a virus doesn't discriminate, we've seen that it now does discriminate?
Well, because it follows the economic realities of the system in which it operates. That is to say, the people who are in touch with the public, the bus drivers, the nurses, many of the doctors, police, fire, a lot of them, especially in the big cities, are Black and Puerto Rican. And they're out there, you know, to feed their families, support their families, and they're in contact. And many of them have very little protection. They're being treated like, essentially, they call them essential workers. But they're being treated essentially like all workers.
They're like,
you know,
they're like
go to work and shut up.
They're like disposable workers.
They are. So if you really are honest about it, to call them essential workers is a lie. It's like calling a prison a correctional institution. You know, and I know they don't do much correcting here. All they do is harass people and make them worse. Essential workers are really disposable workers. They're the people, and as the news has caught up with that reality, and we've gotten the reporting of, say, 60% of the people who are dying in New York are Black and Latino, you've seen other parts of the state, the United States, whiter parts of the state, saying, come on, unlock us, we're not those guys. And we're seeing that. So they're really disposable to the economic and political system.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Thanks to our colleagues with Prison Radio, and special gratitude to Mumia Abu-Jamal. Stay with us. We'll be back after this short break.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Like the river I've been running, running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh yes it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. What's up there beyond the sky? It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh yes it is. Then I go to my brother. Ooh. And I say, brother, help me please. But he wind up knocking.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
Welcome back to Pacifica's national broadcast, COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm Nana Jumphy. Next, we turn to how workers are standing up to unfair labor practices during this pandemic. Steve Zeltzer from Pacifica Radio speaks to us from the Bay Area, also known as KPFA land.
On Saturday, thousands of trade unionists and community people, as well as youth, marched against the murders and systemic racist discrimination taking place in the Bay Area and around the country. I talked with ILWU Local 10 President Trent Willis and ILWU Local 34 President Keith Shanklin about their union's action to shut down all West Coast ports on Juneteenth, June 19th, and rally at the SSA terminal in the Port of Oakland with a march to Oscar Grant Plaza.
Trent Willis, President of the International Longshore Warehouse Union Local 10, want to motivate that we're going to be having a rally on Juneteenth, June 19th, Friday, starting at 10 a.m., starting at 1717 Middle Harbor Road, and we're going to be marching and caravan, a combination. We're going to be marching through the city of Oakland, marching past the Oakland Police Department, and we're going to be ending up at Oscar Grant Plaza. And that's on Friday. I want everybody to come out please join us. We're sending a clear statement to the powers that be, our government. We're sending a clear statement to these corporate bosses that we intend to use our labor, put our labor where our mouth is, and we intend to take economic action if our demands are not met. No matter what part of society you look at, no matter which topic we talk about, in this country, in this capitalist system, the minorities, black and brown, minorities are always disproportionately affected negatively by whatever we're talking about, whether it be employment, whether it be gentrification in neighborhoods, access to medical care, access to social services, access to healthy foods, and just access to this system as a whole. Black and brown people are often disproportionately negatively affected, are denied. This, what you're seeing in the streets now, all of the organizing and protesting, is a testament that people in the United States are tired of this. We've been fighting against this for years. We've been fighting against privatization. We've been fighting against gentrification. The proposed A stadium is a prime example of big business, billionaires, just taking advantage of public land and public trust because they have all of the money. But what they don't realize is that we have all of the labor. And now we are teaming up with the community, which we've been trying to do for years. We're teaming up with the rest of the world, and we plan to put our labor where our mouth is. We plan to take economic action in this country to end systemic racism.
And you've talked about a workers' party. Why do we people in this country need a workers' party?
We absolutely need a workers' party because we need representation for the workers. Okay, the Republicans, as well as the Democrats, do not represent working people. They are actually the enemy of working people. They are the friends of big business and corporations and hedge funds. That's what they're about. We need a party that represents the working man and woman, okay? Just like unions represent workers. We need a government party that represents workers also. A party that cares about our working conditions, okay? Cares about what we go through on the job, cares about a living wage, you know? Cares about access to medical coverage and medical care, you know, and fair pay for women, black women. It goes on and on and on. We desperately need that representation that can help us close this wealth gap.
And this action maybe on the East Coast, what does that mean for Long Shoulder on the West Coast to join with Long Shoulder on the East Coast?
Oh, that would be astronomical. Yeah, that would be astronomical if that could happen. Of course, we all know that the shipping industry is a very crucial industry in this country. And the longshore unions hold a lot of power to make change. If we choose to lay down our tools, it could cost big business and these big bosses a whole lot of money. Now, we're not saying we want to do that. What we want is equal rights. What we want is justice. What we want is an equal opportunity under the law. And we want the law to work for everybody, not just certain people. If all of those demands are met, then there's no reason for workers to shut this country down. Okay? But history will tell you throughout history, the only time structural change has happened in this country is when there was an economic impact. Economic impact against the two parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, who represent big business and not working people.
My name is Keith Shanklin, and I'm the president of Local 34. And the rally that we're about to participate in is the SEIU rally for George Floyd and to stand up against systemic police oppression and systemic police brutality. And we need to understand one thing, that we cannot survive in this world no more with police brutality. It's time for it to end. It's time for All lives matter. All black lives matter. It's time for things to stop. It's time for a change. And this is what we're fighting for, a change. No peace, no more racist police. The world has suffered enough. And after George Floyd was publicly lynched on live TV by a police officer in Minneapolis, Minnesota, David Chauvin, it proves that the world is ready for a change. We are shutting down the ports. Please come out and participate. We will be having a march from Stevens Door Services of America, which is SSA, down to Oscar Grant Plaza. Please come and participate. Show your voice. Protest. That's what the nation was built on, protest. And that's how we're going to end this, on a protest. But we're going to, with our protest, we will be invoking change.
That was the voice of ILWU Local 34 President Keith Shanklin. Before that, we heard from Trent Willis, ILWU Local 10 President, both interviewed by Pacifica Radio's Steve Zeltzer in Oakland, California. Next, we go to New York, the epicenter of the pandemic, as well as the center of protests against police brutality. Johanna Fernandez is producer and host with Pacifica Radio, WBAI, in New York City, and also a scholar and an organizer. Johanna takes us to a protest against police brutality that took place in New York City this past Sunday, June 14th. Let's take a listen.
Black oppression is the biggest contradiction in American society. It is the biggest contradiction in the notion and idea of American freedom. And when black people stand up in this country, other people stand up, Latinos stand up, Muslims stand up, white people stand up, Puerto Ricans stand up, Dominicans stand up. In the last 50 years, the United States has seen the largest transfer that has ever happened in history, wealth transfer from the bottom of society to the top, than at any other moment in history. When that kind of wealth transfer has happened, it's happened because of a military coup or a revolution. In the United States, it happened without a peep because the media convinced every one of us that black people were a menace to society. And the banks and the corporate class ran all the way laughing to the bank. So this is a struggle for the soul of America. It is a struggle to put black people, the least of these, back in their place in this country. Black people were the people who built the wealth in this country. Let us remember. Slavery was the institution upon which capitalism was built. And let me tell you something about the police. The police emerges as an institution to return escaped slaves back to the plantation. That means that we need to get rid of the police. Because white supremacy is in the DNA of the police in America. I write about the Young Lords, the Puerto Rican counterpart to the Black Panther Party. They form part of a coalition initiated by the Black Panther Party called the Rainbow Coalition. Puerto Ricans, Mexicans, Black Americans, but also poor whites from Appalachia. A coalition, the first Rainbow Coalition, organized on the basic idea that we all share a class interest. And capitalism has used black life to divide us, but we are the many and they are the few. And what we need right now is a massive movement led by the black underclass to defeat capitalism and build a new world. Thank you very much. To all my Latinos out here, I'm actually Dominican. streets belong to us. If we don't get it,
shut it down.
If we don't get it,
shut it down.
If we don't get it,
shut it down.
On to a new world. We had to start doing that. Not only defund the police, we had to defund the system. The funds go to the communities. The funds go to our community, black and brown communities. This is what we want. The funds go to the school, the public system. The funds has to go to the health system. That's what we are looking for. That's what we have to fight about.
My brothers and sisters, it is great to see you out here today, but we must remember, the road to justice is long. But one of the things we forgot on our way to justice, on that long road, is who we are. Now I want you to repeat after me. We are.
We are
an African people.
An African people.
We are.
We are
an African people.
An African people.
We are.
We are
an African people.
An African people.
And we must remember those brothers and sisters who march with us on a unity of purpose are also our brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
And when we understand that, we will have the means of justice.
Right.
And one of the means of justice is to end unemployment. We can do that if we control our education budget. It's $30 billion in New York City. We will remember our heroes when we control our education. Our brothers and sisters in the death camps who fought for us to make it possible for us to have this space to continue the struggle for liberation, for freedom, for jobs, for justice. So we must remember those political prisoners. We know them by name, but we don't know them nearly well enough. So they must be in our school curriculum. Those who were there who fought to free us all and to keep us safe. The list is too long to repeat here. We know many have been in the death camps for over 50 years, beginning with our brother, Leonard Peltier, who was an indigenous people when they brought the slaves. He represented them. We all know the name of Mumia, but there are many others. And demand from your history teachers, demand that you know and learn the names of our political prisoners who made it possible for us to be here. What's the call?
Free them all!
What's the call?
Free them all!
What's the call?
Free them all!
Thank you. Thank you, Will Porter!
Thanks to Johanna Fernandez from Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York City. Stay with us. We'll be back after this short break.
Suffer a man, 'cause every time I leave my head above.
everyone. Peace. As a young person, I want to address all the young people in the crowd. And to clarify, everyone under 100, you with that. So first, to the young people, we need you here today. We need you here tomorrow, a week from now, a month from now, a year from now, 10 years from now, 50 years from now. The struggle is long, and you have the time, the energy, the creativity, the fire that we need to make this dream of a new world come true for justice. And we all know white supremacy is a hell of a drug. It makes good into evil, evil into good. It erases history, it degrades people. But we know, and I know, as an Afro-Latino, when black people get free, we all get free. So we're here for George, we're here for Brianna, we're here for Ahmaud, we're here for all the victims of police violence. We're here to free you, we're here to free me, we're coming for everybody. We're coming for this city, we're coming for this country, and we're coming for the world. Young people, rise up!
I was born in the Congo. I walked to the Fertile Crescent and built the Sphinx. I designed a pyramid so tough that a star that only glows every 100 years falls into the center, giving divine, perfect light. I am bad. I sat on the throne drinking nectar with Allah. I got hot and sent an ice age to Europe to cool my thirst. My oldest daughter is Nefertiti. The tears from my birth pains created the Nile. I am a beautiful woman. I gazed on the forest and burned out the Sahara Desert. With a packet of goat's meat and a change of clothes, I crossed it in 2 hours. I am a gazelle, so swift, you can't catch me. For a birthday present when he was 3, I gave my son Hannibal an elephant. He gave me Rome.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy with Nana Jumphy. Alaska is facing a crisis of unemployment and homelessness amid the pandemic. John Scudder reports.
For Pacifica Radio's COVID, Race, and Democracy, this is John Scudder from KEUL Glacier City Radio in Girdwood, Alaska. Alaska's crises amid the COVID pandemic are deepening. In this report, we will cover homelessness, food security, unemployment, and the 200 Alaskan healthcare workers who asked Alaska's governor to mandate the wearing of masks in businesses where social distancing is difficult to maintain. In the wake of the growing COVID pandemic, the consequences of opening the state's economy early reaps the plagues of human blight. Amongst these issues are the continuing opioid crisis, growing unemployment, and the deepening of Alaska's homeless problem. 25% of Alaskan workers have filed initial jobless claims over 10 weeks through May 16th, numbers that are astronomical in comparison to a year ago. Demand at food pantries has recently skyrocketed by 75%, according to the Food Bank of Alaska. The agency said calls for help with rent and utility assistance, food, emergency shelter, and other immediate needs jumped by nearly 3 times over the same period last year. Many more Alaskans will face homelessness in the weeks and months ahead. At a time of compassion fatigue, when many residents vent their frustrations on the problems on social media and in public forums, a state law is forestalling evictions and foreclosures until June 30th. Without an extension, homeless numbers will explode as families who lost incomes run out of money and options. Since there is no going back to the way things were before COVID, the state's outlook is grim as well. Alaska's active COVID case count hit a new high June 13th. Since the pandemic began in March, the number of Alaskan residents who have tested positive but not yet recovered also rose to a new high, according to the state's medical COVID data. Alaska Governor Michael Dunleavy fully reopened the state's economy and lifted most coronavirus restrictions on May 22nd after weeks of low daily case counts. Now the state is experiencing infection clusters, a rise in deaths, and an increase in hospitalizations. As a result, more than 200 physicians and healthcare workers across Alaska have signed a letter to Governor Dunleavy urging him to mandate the wearing of masks in businesses where social distancing is difficult to maintain. In an address to the state of Alaska on June 10th, Governor Dunleavy said he will not make the wearing of masks mandatory. The Alaska Healthcare Professional letter says, recent medical studies and real-world evidence supports the use of masks to prevent the spread of the virus. The letter stipulates that mask wearing should be required in businesses open to the public where 6-foot distancing is unrealistic. The healthcare workers' plea comes during the recent surge in COVID cases across the state, just weeks after restrictions on businesses were lifted in response to low case counts. Alaska's struggles with the pandemic are renewing, as evidenced by the rising case counts, even though its people and politicians have sought to return to normal routines. In the weeks ahead, we will delve deeper into health, economic, transportation, and the COVID impacts on rural Alaskan villages. For Pacifica Radio, this is John Scudder from KEUL Glacier City Radio in Girdwood, Alaska, with our COVID news of the day.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily show produced by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates around the country. Find out more about our work at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org.
You are listening to COVID, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Nana Jumphy. We conclude with some advice from a duo of doctors who are also producers of the Noise Filter Show, a podcast out of New Orleans that airs on Pacifica affiliate 102.3 FM WHIV-LP, a program of the New Orleans Society for Infectious Disease Awareness.
Face masks triumph again. Hey, Doc, a man in a face mask walks into a bank and pulls out a coffee cup at the bank teller. The teller goes, "Are you trying to mug me?"
Dude, just get on with it.
All right, let's talk about masking. This story has a happy ending. Let's file this one under how natural experiments can also be happy ones as well. Now, Great Clip Salon in Springfield, Missouri opened after being shut down for the pandemic, and there were two stylists who returned to work, and they were actually symptomatic for COVID-19, and they returned to work while symptomatic. So let me stop here and say, please, if you are sick, do not go to work. I understand personal finances and, you know, the weak state of our safety net program likely necessitated return to work for these two stylists in particular. Anyway, these two stylists ended up testing positive for the novel coronavirus, and contact tracing identified 140 clients and 6 other stylists. Well, now here's the good news. After waiting the 14 days of the incubation period of the virus, all of the contacts tested negative. Wait, what? How can this be? The public health authorities have attributed the required use of masks at the salon as being responsible for the lack of transmission. To be clear, the chairs of the salon were distant and the salon staggered their clients as well. But Doc, this is great news, and this is another awesome story showing how effective masks can be.
Yeah, Doc. Here at Noise Filter, we've advocated from the beginning that mask wearing is an incredibly important tool for limiting transmission of COVID-19. You've actually written an op-ed about it and have been jumping up and down since the very beginning. While the results are by no means scientific, what this natural experiment shows is that mask wearing, even with those that are positive, prevents transmission of the virus. We've reported on Noise Filter that indoor transmission is the greatest risk for spread, and in this case, masks were shown to be effective in limiting the virus at the source, the mouth. Hey, Doc, what do you call a rumor regarding a mask?
What?
a masquerade.
Oh, yeah. Come on. Let's move on to the next story.
That's better than yours. Come on. First one, maybe.
Shutdowns prevented 60 million coronavirus infections in the U.S., study finds. Since the start of the coronavirus epidemic, there's been a lot of debate about the efficacy of strict social distancing practices in relation to the negative economic impact it can cause. Now that some time has passed since the start of government-sanctioned lockdown orders, data about the effect of stay-at-home orders and other restrictions on the spread of disease is starting to emerge. One study recently found that approximately 60 million novel coronavirus infections were prevented by the social distancing measures in the United States. A separate study found that social distancing dropped infection rates by an average of 82% in 11 European countries, limiting contagion to below epidemic levels.
You know, Doc, these are some pretty incredible numbers. It is estimated that in the initial period before shutdowns, the number of infections, and this is something that you talk about all the time, were doubling roughly every 2 days. And the goal of social distancing was to stop those exponential transmission rates. And I think we can safely conclude that it was effective.
I agree. The teams compiling this data investigated many different aspects of closure, including business and religious center closings, the cancellation of events, travel bans, quarantining positive cases, and work-from-home orders. For example, banning large gatherings was shown to be particularly effective in France and South Korea. Doc, anything to add?
Yes, indeed. Actually, both studies that were referenced today have made one thing clear. This pandemic is far from over. Only 3-4% of people in the country studied have been infected to date. That's leaving a vast majority of people. We're talking 95-96% that are still susceptible to the virus. Abandoning all precautions increases the risk of a second wave of infection. Again, something you talk about all the time as well, Dr. Griggs. Now, the other thing these studies make clear is the importance and effectiveness of preventative measures. There are many countries who are still at the beginning of their battle with COVID-19, and these statistics show the health benefits of imposing shutdowns, even if there are weighty social and economic costs. As more data and resources become available, I think the focus of prevention of transmission will shift towards strategic methods of testing, contact tracing, and the isolation of infected patients. And then, of course, let me also add mask, mask, and mask.
Doc, did you say mask?
We just heard part of the Noise Filter Show, produced by Dr. Mark Allen Deary and colleagues at Pacifica's affiliate, 102.3 FM, WHIV LP in New Orleans. This concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and its radio affiliates that contributed to the production of this show. Special thanks to Verna Avery Brown at WPFW and to Fernando Velasquez at KPFK for advice and support. I'm Nana Jumphy. Thanks for listening, and make sure to tune in tomorrow.
This has been COVID, Race, and Democracy, a daily broadcast by Pacifica Radio and its affiliates, produced by a group of committed men and women volunteers willing to make a difference. If you tuned in late, you can listen and download the show from our YouTube channel, Pacifica Foundation TV, or from the website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Tell a friend about it. It will be worth it.